In the 1960s, as a small boy growing up on Long Island, I was obsessed with the space program. Mercury, Gemini, Apollo. And, of course, in late July 1969, just a few days before I turned 11 years old, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin became the first humans to walk on the moon. And I went to bed that night after watching it on our black and white TV, looking out the window at the moon and being amazed that people were up there for the first time ever. At the same time, a six-year-old boy somewhere else on Long Island was doing the same thing and was similarly awed. The difference between us is that that boy actually grew up to be an astronaut. I dreamed of it. He actually did it. His name is Mike Massimino. He's a veteran now of two space shuttle missions. He was the first person to tweet from space. He's got a recurring role on The Big Bang Theory. He's the one who nicknamed Howard Wolowitz Fruit Loops. And now he's written about his life in a book called Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. Mike, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It was a remarkable thing to be looking up at the sky that night. And how long was it from that moment until the day you took off for your first time in space?
Well, that happened in 1969, and my first space flight was in 2002. So about, 33 years later, I was able to actually get into space myself.
I want to read something that you write in the prologue to your book about that first launch. You say, right after we launched, I realized that all the training we'd had on what to do if something went wrong during launch, how to bail out, how to operate the parachutes, how to make the emergency landing, I realized that all those years of training were completely pointless. It was just filler to make us feel okay about climbing onto this thing. Because if it's going down, it's going down. It's either going to be a good day or it's going to be a bad day. There is no in-between. All those emergency placards and safety signs all over the interior of the shuttle telling you what to do and where to go, that's there to give you something to read before you die. What a great description of that. You also in the book say you were really scared that day. Looking up at this rocket that you had to sit atop. Why were you so scared after all that training?
Well, there's nothing like actually doing it for real, and the day you launch is a bit different. As I describe in the book, they don't fuel the shuttle with the liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, rocket fuel, until just a few hours before the launch. So other times I've been out to a space shuttle, up close to a space shuttle, it had not been fueled, and it's a lot of people hanging around it, and it seemed okay. You know, it was just kind of sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
But on that particular day, when we got out there, it was fueled, of course, and then it seemed like a beast. It seemed like it was alive, and it was a much different experience being out there on launch day. Plus, it was the middle of the night. You know, it was dark out, and it was scary. And it just hit me that, looking up at that thing, that maybe this wasn't such a good idea. But at that point, it was too late.
Yeah, you can't turn around.
I had to get on board.
You can't turn around and get a ride back because the guy who gives you the ride, he's gone, right?
That's right. I actually did look for them. You know, they take you out there in an Astro van. They call it the Astro van. And I was looking for that dude, and he was gone. You know, he's the bus driver just drops you off, and he's not waiting around to pick anybody up. He's just like, see you guys later. He wants to get out of that area.
I was just kidding.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Hey, wait a minute. Yeah.
I'm curious about this. Once you get up there, is there anything in your training that prepares you for the first time you look out the window down at Earth?
No, there really isn't. It is just so beautiful to be up there and to see that, that there's absolutely nothing that can get you ready for that. There really isn't. It's, you know, you're very well trained to do your job, turning of the wrench, so to speak, and everything you're going to be doing on the shuttle. But really, nothing can prepare you for what you're going to see. You look at photos, just like I'm sure you have as well, Paul. But that doesn't do it justice. And even IMAX movies and other experiences just don't quite do it justice. And when you're out there, particularly during the spacewalk, when we were at Hubble, we're 100 miles higher than where the space station flies, and we can see the curve of the planet. It looks like a gigantic globe, and right there in front of you, and you can turn your head and look anywhere you want. when you're out there looking at that, it's really overwhelming, and nothing can prepare you for it. One of my thoughts was, and I describe it in the book, that I felt like this was the view from heaven, and I was out on a spacewalk looking at the planet, and then I thought about that for a moment, and I was like, no, it's more beautiful than that. That's not right. This is what heaven must look like, and I really felt like I was looking into a paradise, and that's how I feel about the planet now. I believe we're living in a paradise.
Really changes your perspective when you can't see the lines.
That's right. You don't see the lines on the maps. Sometimes you see a river or something that'll form a border, a natural border. But yeah, you don't see the lines of the borders between countries.
Is it true that at night
when you're in space?
Is it true that at night you can't see North Korea?
No, it's pretty black. It's like a blackout. South Korea is lit up, and you can see the border. You can see the border where the lights end. That's the border between South and North Korea.
How do you sleep that first night of your first shuttle flight, considering that night and day come every 90 minutes as you orbit? And here you are, you're excited. It's the first time in space. How do you possibly go to sleep?
Yeah, that's a bit of an issue. For me, I was pretty excited about it. I got sick my first day in space. Most astronauts do. A little bit of stomach awareness, and I actually threw up my first day in space. I didn't feel very well. I was able to get my work done, but I didn't feel that great. So I took an anti-nausea medication, and that helped me. I think that helped me go to sleep. So having a shot of the anti-nausea medication helped not only kill the nausea, but also put me to sleep. So that helped a lot.
Yeah.
But you're right in that you are pretty excited. And I remember, there were nights when I was on the shuttle. I particularly remember after my first spacewalk, as I was floating there in my sleeping bag, about to close my eyes, thinking, "Wow, what have these eyes seen today, and what will they see tomorrow?" It's just such an extraordinary experience of being up there that, yeah, as you go to bed, you're tired. You're ready to get some rest, but it's hard to just relax at times and fall asleep. But yeah, after a couple of days, I was pretty much used to it.
I have a question. When you did a spacewalk, how did you feel about that when you were getting ready to go out and thinking, what am I doing now? First of all, I was strapped to this thing and I was scared to death about going up, and now I'm actually going to go walking out in space.
Yeah. What is really the matter with me? It's a lot of anticipation of what's going to happen. I remember looking at that door, the airlock, the door to space, and being in the airlock during our depressurization and prep procedure. And the last few moments of that, you're in there with your spacewalking buddy, and the inner hatch is closed, and you in the airlock, you're depressing the airlock, getting rid of all the atmosphere out of it, and then you're going to open the door when you're at zero atmosphere in the airlock, open the door, the hatch that leads to space to do your spacewalk. And I remember, thinking, that really is space. Although I had been in space for a few days before my first spacewalk, this was a much different experience. It's kind of like if you're in the room, look around the room you're in right now in your studio. If you all of a sudden launch into space and then now you're floating around, you can look out the window if there is one there. But you're still inside of that room. And that's kind of what I felt like in the space shuttle, that I had launched into space, but I was still inside of the spacecraft, even though I was in space with it. When you go outside, I really felt like I was stepping outside, like I was going in the backyard. And it was a much different experience for me.
Yeah. I used to scuba dive, and I remember clearly not only were the visuals amazing, but the audio was only me breathing. I assume that's the same thing when you take those spacewalks.
Yeah, it is. You can hear the only noises you can hear. You can hear your own breathing, any noises you might make inside of there, and you can bang all you want outside on the space shuttle with a tool or whatever you have available, and you won't hear that sound because it can't reach you. You do hear a fan noise. It's like this in the back of your head. You can hear the fan going in your backpack, in your life support system. And that fan circulates air and water in your system, inside your life support system. So cooling water and breathing air and atmosphere and scrubs your breathing air. But it makes this humming noise. So you hear that. and then you hear, only thing you're going to hear is what's coming in through your headset. You have a what we call a Snoopy cap on, because it looks like Snoopy ears on when you wear the thing, and it's got a microphone, microphones in front of you, and you can hear what's coming through that communications cap, but that's all you can hear.
You mentioned that if you banged on the spacecraft with a hammer or something, you couldn't hear it because you're only hearing the stuff inside your suit. Is it making a sound?
It sure is, yeah. In fact, you hear that inside of the space shuttle when, if you're inside the spacecraft and, inside the space shuttle, the space station, and some of the spacewalkers come into the airlock to get some tools or do something, they start banging around in there. You hear it inside because the noise will resonate and travel within the structure of the spaceship. And since you have atmosphere inside the spaceship, it gives it a medium for it to travel, for the sound wave to travel, and you can hear them banging around. Like, hey, cut it out then. But they can't hear a thing. So they don't know what's going on. They're like, hey, you guys are waking us up. Be quiet. They have no clue.
But outside, outside the spaceship, in space, there is no sound, right?
There is. You won't. So the sound is still being generated, but it can't travel. So the sound wave itself will not travel in space.
Because there's no air.
There's no air, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
So it can't, and you're, it's interesting, even in our spacesuits, you can't whistle while you work while you're in a spacesuit because you're at a lower pressure. We lower the pressure inside of the spacesuits to 4.3 pounds per square inch. At sea level, one atmosphere, you have 14.7 pounds per square inch. And you lower that pressure inside of a spacesuit. When you're at vacuum, you're at just a small amount of pressure, and you can't whistle. Your voice sounds. I felt like I was ready to cut a blues album when I was up there. But your voice sounds a lot different. You can't. Yeah, and you cannot whistle because you cannot excite enough air molecules around you in that atmosphere to vibrate to cause a sound when you try to whistle.
Wow. You write in the book about the work you were doing to literally save the Hubble Space Telescope, which is one of the most remarkable technological advances mankind has ever done. Here's one thing I have to ask. How do you keep all the little screws from flying away or getting lost? Because anybody who's ever tried to build something at home, you know you're looking around going, where is that screw?
Yeah, exactly. And you can't have anything get loose. We were panicked about the possibility of losing something and getting, because if it gets inside of the telescope, if you get a screw inside of the telescope, outside isn't great neither, but outside you can knock it away or it'll eventually go somewhere else. But inside, if it gets caught inside the telescope, then those fancy wall calendars people are buying for Christmas with Hubble images on them of the universe, we're all going to have a screw inside of it, and they'll probably name it after me. So we did not want that to happen while we were up there. So you have to be really careful. What we did for this one particular repair that you might be referring to, we had 111 small screws to remove from an access panel. And what we did is we helped design with the engineers we worked with at the Goddard Space Flight Center, at the Johnson Space Center. We designed a capture plate that went over that instrument, and so every one of those screws would be contained in a labyrinth within this capture plate, so we wouldn't lose anything. You are very, very concerned. You cannot just lose things. Let things get loose when you're working on the telescope.
No, definitely not.
No.
Hey, where's Mike? Oh, he's on a spacewalk to chase down those three screws he lost.
Yeah, no, that's good. Yeah, don't chase it. Yeah, that's the other thing. Don't chase after it. More problems. Yeah, these are all things you pick up as an astronaut. Use and don't.
I have to ask you about John Glenn, who, as you know, died a few weeks ago and was a real space pioneer. What did he mean to you?
Well, like I think a lot of the country, particularly those who can remember him, I'm too young to remember his flight. He flew in space before I was born, but I certainly heard his name growing up and knew what a hero he was. I met him when he came to the Johnson Space Center to train for his space shuttle flight, SDS-95. And he was very much interested in just kind of being one of the guys, so to speak. He went to the gym. We'd see him in the gym. We'd see him around the hall, around the water cooler, and he would talk to us. And he wanted to be friends with us. He was just a wonderful guy. And as his flight approached, each shuttle crew picks two astronauts to be their family escorts, to be with their families. And the SDS-95 crew asked me and another guy, Kent Rominger, the two of us to be their family escorts. And so I got to know John really well at that point, along with his wife Annie and his two children, David and Lynn, and the grandchildren that were there. And just wonderful people. He had an incredible relationship with his wife. If you watch any of the ceremonies, they talk about that. Anyone that met him and met his wife at the same time knew there was something special about the way they treated each other and felt about each other. Just an amazing partnership. She was very much involved. He was very much attached to her. And they really were great with each other. The last story I want to tell you, though, is when I was writing the book, my editor and I made a list of people we wanted to send the book to, the early version, the galley version of the book, the draft, more or less, to see if we could get a few endorsements, like blurbs for the back of the book. And when we thought about astronauts, our number one choice was John Glenn. And I reached out to him and got an answer from his secretary at Ohio State. She said, you know, Mike, yes, the senator would be very, very happy to do this, send the book. So I sent the book, and about a month or so later, I hadn't heard anything. And I called the secretary, and I wrote her a note. I said, hey, you know, did the senator not like the book? I mean, why haven't I heard back? You know, I was wondering if something might have happened. And what happened was that she wrote back to me and said, Mike, the senator is having trouble seeing. His vision is failing. We're trying to find someone to read the book to him.
Oh.
And that's what they did. They found someone to read him my book. And so he could generate an endorsement, or, you know, a quote or what, you know, something if he liked it. And he did like it. And he wrote me a very nice blurb, a very nice note. And that's on the back of my cover of my book is a little blurb from John Glenn. And I tell you that story because to me, that shows what kind of guy he was. Even though, you know, he was an older guy, he obviously his health was failing. I almost felt terrible that I asked him. I didn't know that he was having trouble seeing, but he, you know, he wanted to do it. And he was not going to, go back on that promise. And he found someone to read him the book and wrote a very nice endorsement for it. But I think that kind of sums up who he was. I mean, really, who am I? Yeah, I'm another astronaut, but I was, you know, half his age. Well, not quite half his age. I'm a little older than that. I'm in my 50s now, 54. But, you know, here I am just a regular astronaut, but yet he was not going to. He was going to help me when I asked him to do a favor. That's the kind of guy he was. He was the real deal.
Yeah, he had the right stuff, if I could coin a phrase.
He had the right stuff. I think so many times, you know, we idolize people and these heroes that we have, and then you meet him and you're like, well, maybe it was because I really thought he'd be great, but he wasn't as cool as I thought he was. And sometimes you get disappointed. But you didn't get disappointed with him.
Would you go back?
He was better than advertised.
Would you go back into space at age 77 like he did?
Yeah, I'd do it. Sure, why not? I mean, I would love to do it. I don't think that's going to happen. But you're going into space. I hope to go back into space. I miss it. I'm no longer with NASA, but I certainly hope that I get a chance with one of these commercial companies. I hope they're successful. I'd be very happy to be a stewardess on board as well. I don't necessarily need to do anything, you know, overly taxing, like fly the spaceship, but I'd be very happy to contribute in any way.
Serve
so I hope to get a chance to go back.
Yeah, peanuts and coffee and things like that.
and whatever you need, man. I'll do whatever.
The praise on the back of the book does come from three of my heroes, John Glenn, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and Bill Nye, the science guy. The book is called Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. Mike Massimino, thank you for the book and for your time today. It's great talking to you.
Well, really appreciate it. I enjoyed it. It's a great way to kind of end the week for me and move on to family activities for the holidays. So I hope you guys enjoy your holiday, and I can't thank you enough for having me on. Thank you.
My pleasure. The same to you. This is the Big 550 KTRS.